This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. Natural gas has been touted by everyone from President Obama to the billionaire Koch brothers as the fuel that will help us achieve both energy independence and a cleaner electricity system. Alas, the story is not quite so neat and simple, as controversy over fracking and projects like the Keystone XL pipeline suggest. Methane itself is a greenhouse gas many times more powerful than carbon dioxide, and fuel mining isn't the only way it makes its way into the atmosphere. Methane naturally bubbles up from cracks in the sea floor, and as the planet warms, scientists increasingly fear we may see major releases of methane from Arctic permafrost. So is methane a good thing or a bad thing? Or, as is likely the answer, a bit of both. Today, we turn to three experts to help us demystify methane. Joining me in our Woods Hole studio is Jeff Seawald, senior scientist in the Department of Marine Chemistry and Geochemistry at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, Carolyn Ruppel, head of the Gas Hydrates Group at the U.S. Geological Survey, and Sue Natale, assistant scientist at Woods Hole Research Center. Welcome to Living Lab.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning.
We invite you to join our conversation as well. Our phone number is 866-999-4626. Our email address is livinglabradio@capeandislands.org. You can also find Living Lab Radio on Twitter or on Facebook. Now, Jeff Seawald, let's start with the basics, because I think one of the things about the whole natural gas methane story that can be so confusing is that it comes in so many forms. So first of all, is methane natural gas, or is natural gas something more than just methane alone?
Well, methane is natural gas in many situations. Natural gas is a catch-all term for gas that's produced naturally by a whole very broad spectrum of natural processes. And in many cases, in most cases, is predominantly composed of methane. But there are several situations where gas produced naturally in the environment contains high concentrations of other gases, such as nitrogen or CO2. And there are many different processes involved in the production of natural gas. Many don't involve biology. They're purely abiotic or result from the heating of organic matter in the environment. And many of the processes do include biology, and it is a product of microbial activity in a broad variety of environments.
So when we think about oil, fossil fuel, as we have typically thought of it, it's very old plant material that has been compressed and heated over so long that it eventually becomes oil. Is that one of the ways that what you're talking about with it, that natural gas can be formed?
Correct. When living matter is deposited on the seafloor, it is buried over the course of millions of years. And as it is buried deeper and deeper in basins, it is heated, and the decomposition of the organic matter results in the production of large quantities of gas and liquid oil that we produce for energy.
Well, and we've seen those two, the natural gas and the oil, do often occur in the same place. We saw that with the Gulf oil spill, that what was coming out was not only oil, there was also the gas that was coming out as well.
That's correct. In fact, the petroleum that was leaking at the seafloor during the Deepwater Horizon oil spill, at atmospheric conditions, the volume of gas was approximately 1,600 to 1,700 times the volume of oil that was produced in that spill.
Now, Carolyn Ruppel, talking about this, the gas leaking from the seafloor, this is often known as gas hydrates when it comes out. Again, is that just methane, or is this, again, what we were talking about with the natural gas, kind of a mixture of different things?
Well, gas hydrate actually refers to a combination of gas and basically it's a frozen water that occurs mostly actually in the sediments. So sometimes it occurs at the seafloor, but the deal is that is only stable at certain pressures and temperatures. And so as it nears the seafloor in some conditions, it will break down and will emit the gas stream. So the water from the frozen ice part will stay in the sediment, and then the gas stream will be emitted. And that's a finding that increasingly people are seeking now in places that are right at the edge of this stability zone. And the question then becomes whether climate change, temperature variations, are causing some of that gas hydrate to break down in the sediment and then release the methane into the overlying ocean.
And Sue Natale, in addition to finding methane, natural gas in its various forms under the ocean, there's also a lot of it locked in ice in the permanently frozen ground, the permafrost in the Arctic. How much methane is there, and how did it get there?
So there are methane hydrates in permafrost as well, but the bigger concern when we're talking about permafrost and permafrost thaw and methane release from permafrost is carbon that's currently organic carbon. So it's not methane right now. That carbon has been accumulating for thousands of years because as plants die, the ground freezes, and it's been remaining as organic carbon. But as that carbon thaws, as the permafrost thaws, microbes break down that carbon and release it as carbon dioxide or as methane, depending on whether the ground is saturated or not. So in terms of organic carbon, there's currently about 1,700 petagrams. So that's twice as much carbon as is contained currently in our atmosphere. So the question is, we have this carbon pool, and how much of that is going to be released? How much will be released as methane or as carbon dioxide?
So, Jeff Seawald, let's address this question of methane versus carbon dioxide and what makes something a more powerful greenhouse gas. So what is it about methane that is of such concern in terms of climate change?
Well, methane is a, in terms of the radiative properties relative to CO2, is about 20 to 25 times more powerful a greenhouse gas. So
it literally just traps more of the solar radiation.
Yes, in terms of the ability to trap heat from the sun. So although CO2 may be more abundant, very small amounts of methane in the atmosphere have a disproportionate effect relative to CO2.
And it's important to note that methane is transformed via photolytic processes, so processes that involve reactions that include light, to CO2 within about 10 years in the atmosphere. So even if you start with methane, you end up with CO2. Another thing that's important is that you're mentioning methane emissions themselves, but of course most methane that we use in our homes, for example, is burned. And once you burn it, you get CO2. It's just that the CO2 produced in that process the amount of CO2 produced in that process is quite different than the amount produced by, for example, the comparable amount of coal or the comparable amount of crude oil.
So why is that? Why is it that one fuel can be cleaner in that way, produce less carbon dioxide, if you're talking essentially about the same amount of energy being produced?
Well, it fundamentally comes down to the energy that's contained in the molecules. So methane is the most reduced form of carbon, and so the amount of chemical energy that's released when you burn it as heat is much higher than these other forms of carbon.
So essentially, almost by being a simpler molecule, it's a more efficient form of the molecule.
Yeah, the heat content is higher than these other fuels.
So it is, in fact, a cleaner fuel, and I think there's some confusion about whether or not it's even a fossil fuel. And we were actually talking about this a little bit earlier, that this is another one of those things about methane that gets very confusing, because we were talking about the versions of natural gas and gas hydrates kind of that were formed largely like oil was. But we can also, there's all these processes that are creating methane right now. And even when you have methane being created today, it's sometimes considered fossil. So explain what that means.
Yeah, we use the term fossil to refer to hydrocarbons that are very old. But you can also form methane from carbon that is very old. So there's sometimes the methane is actually very young. It's being formed by microbial activity in sediments, in permafrost. But the carbon source is very many millions of years old or thousands of years old.
So you have that plant material from very long ago that is sitting there, hasn't yet become oil. And when microbes eat that, create methane. And yet, despite the fact that they're producing it today, we call that fossil.
Correct.
No wonder this is such a confusing issue. I mean, it comes in so many different forms. And even it must be hard as scientists studying different aspects of this. I mean, how much are you able to keep abreast of what is going on in the different fields? Because it's all related, and yet it is different in its own subtle ways. I mean, so Sue, Natalie, how much are you keeping up, you know, on a personal or professional level with, say, what's going on with gas hydrates or with with natural gas from the Gulf oil spill when what you're studying primarily is the Arctic?
Yeah, so I'm keeping up on it as much as I can, but certainly you wind up really focusing on your research area. And I don't think that I could, you know, have a really strong discussion about the processes that are driving what's going on in the ocean, because the processes that are going on in permafrost, we're still trying to figure those out, you know. And in terms of the numbers, we're still trying to figure out what's going to happen to the carbon that's in the permafrost. And it's a complicated story. You know, as I said, you have a pool of carbon and we still don't know what's going to happen to it, because it's not just that it thaws and then it all gets released. Some of it may stay there. Some may be released as methane. Some may be released as carbon dioxide. It's not just temperature. This is also driven by, in large part, by soil moisture. So in permafrost, you know, when the ground thaws, it may get very wet and be a very boggy type of situation where you're going to get a lot of methane released. You may get complete thawing of the permafrost where the ground drains, in which case it's very dry, and then you may get no methane. Methane in terrestrial systems is also driven by the type of vegetation that's there. So when you have areas with a lot of sedges, they act basically as a straw in some cases, and so the methane then has a pathway to go to the atmosphere. You also have a situation where you have methane produced in soil, say, you know, 20 centimeters down. But if the surface of the soil is dry, it may never get to the atmosphere. So you can have methane produced, but it may have no impact on the atmosphere because there's also microbes that are basically eating that methane, oxidizing it. And yes, they're converting it to carbon dioxide, but the methane itself is not making it to the atmosphere. So,
And I was just going to ask about that. So bacteria are one of the sources of methane, but there are bacteria out there that eat methane, and you're talking about that in permafrost. We also saw that with the Gulf oil spill, right?
Correct. All of them are. There's no indication that any of the methane or a significant fraction of the methane that was released during the Gulf oil spill actually made it to the atmosphere. And part of the reason for that is that as the methane was released at the seafloor, it had to pass through 1,500 meters of water, of seawater. A significant fraction dissolved in the water column, and then there's a large ecosystem of microbes that is very effective at eating the methane, and so they oxidize it to carbon dioxide, and eventually it is consumed in the environment.
No, go ahead, Caroline.
And well, I think it's also, as Jeff is well aware, in the oceans, it's an even wider issue than that. So you have methane that's trying to get out of the seafloor, so there can be physical barriers to that, but a lot of that methane is, if you will, eaten by microbes before it even gets out. I mean, in most normal places, the estimate is probably over 80%. And then you get into the ocean waters, and again, the methane is consumed by microbes. It also is dissolving in the ocean, and it can remain there for a long time. But one thing I always say is just because it doesn't get out the top, and it usually doesn't get out the top, it doesn't get across the ocean-atmosphere interface. If the methane's emitted at, let's say, nominally deeper than about 100 meters water depth, it's not innocuous, because all these processes we're talking about, these oxidation processes, lead to an increase in ocean acidification, and they also deoxygenate the water. So you end up with effectively dead zones with less oxygen in them.
So, I mean, as you're saying, we're still getting carbon dioxide out of all of this. And one of the, you know, we talked about methane being much more powerful, much more potent in terms of trapping heat, but that it doesn't stick around very long. In some cases, methane may not even be making it to the atmosphere. What's coming out is carbon dioxide, but then the carbon dioxide sticks around for much longer. I mean, that's one of the other major differences between methane and carbon dioxide, right?
Right, but the residence times in the oceans are thought to be about a few hundred years. So
For the carbon dioxide.
Some of it will eventually get out because of ocean circulation. It'll come to the surface. But I think maybe we've talked about this before. I think the bottom line is that the CO2, that amount of CO2, in reality, when you're looking at the amount that's put into the atmosphere from anthropogenic sources versus this extra amount that would come out, say, because of methane emissions and changing that methane into CO2 into CO2 in the water, that amount is probably a very small fraction of what we're putting into the atmosphere anthropogenically.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, yeah, the current atmospheric CO2 concentrations are, you know, 400 parts per million, and methane is less than 2 parts per billion. Is that?
It's about 1.78.
Yeah. So it's orders of magnitude more. So you do have some of this methane being converted to carbon dioxide, or all the methane, most of the methane being converted to carbon dioxide, but that's not the main source of carbon dioxide. That's not our main concern.
So the natural sources of methane and thus carbon dioxide to the atmosphere are being dwarfed at this point by the fossil fuel burning sources.
Well, that's not true with the natural sources.
Yeah. Natural sources of methane are quite high.
They're about 80. So it's about 550 teragrams of methane per year in the latest Intergovernmental Panel Climate Change Assessments.
And is that a number that has been, we think, changing and increasing, or is that kind of, we think that's been steady for a while? That's just the natural turnover of methane.
It's increasing, but about 60% of that is anthropogenic right now. So obviously, 300 years ago, that number was very small. The anthropogenic portion was very small, and the amount in the atmosphere was much smaller.
Yeah, so the amount in the atmosphere has increased since pre-industrial by about 150%. Right. So 40% right now estimated is biological. The concentrations in the atmosphere, the rate of increase leveled off up until about 2006, and then they've been increasing exponentially. The question is where this latest increase is coming from. Now, some of that may be from leaks from fossil fuel extraction, and some of it may be from natural sources. One potential natural source is thawing permafrost. Rates of methane production from wetlands and permafrost had, I think, in the past been considered to be quite low, or lower than the tropics, because it's cold and because we have, most of the time the ground's frozen, so you're not getting any methane loss. There's a recent synthesis that came out in Global Methane Production, and they found methane rates produced in the Arctic and some of these recently thawed areas that cause wetlands when they thaw, equal to some methane production happening in wetlands in the tropics. So the numbers are higher than were previously known from these natural sources in permafrost. And the other thing to think about when we talk about natural versus anthropogenic, it's kind of a fuzzy line, because a lot of these natural sources are increasing because we're putting more fossil fuels into the atmosphere. So what's natural is tricky to say. It's gray area.
That's Sue Natale of Woods Hole Research Center. Also with me this morning, Carolyn Ruppel, head of the Gas Hydrates Program at the U.S. Geological Survey, and Jeff Seawald, senior scientist at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. We will talk more about the changing role of methane in our atmosphere in a few moments. You're listening to Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. More after a short break. This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. We're talking today about methane, the major component in natural gas, and its surprisingly complex role in the environment and how that is changing as a result of some of our own activities. With me in our Woods Hole studio, Sue Natale of the Woods Hole Research Center, Carolyn Ruppel from U.S. Geological Survey, and Jeff Seawald from Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. We also welcome your questions and comments. Give us a call toll-free at 866-999-4626. Send email to livinglabradio@capeandislands.org, or you can find Living Lab Radio on Twitter or Facebook. Now, we were talking before the break about the really diverse array of places that you find methane, all of the different ways that it then gets out of those places in the ground, in the seafloor, into the atmosphere, and the blurring at this point of the line between a natural release of methane and a human release of methane. And it seems that one of the issues here, I mean, you know, throwing around some numbers, but a lot of it is still really unclear. And Carolyn Ruppel, your group just recently published a paper showing that there are hundreds of places off the east coast of the United States where gas hydrates, this form of methane, is leaking up from the seafloor that we never knew about before. So how surprising were your findings, and how did you find those if we'd never known about them before?
Well, we primarily found them by using, it wasn't really new technology, it was in sort of application of old technology that hadn't been used too frequently before. And we looked for plumes of gas in the water column. And this was actually has a nice linkage to something that I know WCAI has reported on in the past, which is the NOAA Ocean Exploration Program collected all the data that we used. We used about 94,000 square kilometers of data. And we looked for these methane plumes on the east coast of the United States. And we found about 570 new methane seeps that had not been found.
So when you say you looked for them, were you literally looking at video imagery or was this chemical data looking for methane in the water?
Well, it's sound that goes into the water column and it bounces off the gas in the water column differently than it bounces off other parts of the water. So that difference tells us that there's a plume there. So it's basically an acoustic method.
And it's literally gas bubbles?
Yes, it's gas bubbles. And so there are various acoustic methods one can use, and some can provide more quantification about the size of the bubbles and what the flux of the methane is. What we were doing was what I would say is fairly binary. Is there a plume or is there not a plume? And what our finding was that about 67% of these plumes were sitting on a place on the margin we call the upper slope. And so the upper slope is a place where the gas hydrate, this frozen form of water and methane, the stability of that sort of pinches out. So it's right at the edge. And if you start warming temperatures just a little bit, the methane hydrate can break down and release its methane. Right now, it's just a postulate that some of this is related to methane hydrate. We have to prove that. There had been previous findings in the Arctic Ocean on the margin of Svalbard, which is part of Norway, very high in the Arctic, that they had seen hundreds of seeps in the same setting where small perturbations in the water temperature have been caused by gas hydrate breakdown. And my group actually has been looking for this in the U.S. Arctic in the Beaufort Sea for 5 years now, but only has circumstantial evidence there. So finding it at mid-latitudes was kind of surprising because the rate of warming in mid-latitudes, like on the Atlantic margin, there the rate of warming is not as rapid as it is in the Arctic, where we had gone to look for it because we thought this is sort of the low-hanging fruit of trying to find it.
So in finding hundreds of seeps out there that were kind of surprising, is your thinking at this point that we simply hadn't looked hard enough before and they've always been there? Or is the thinking that this is something new that is being caused by changes in ocean temperature?
So I think it's a two-sided story. I think what I always talk about is nested timescales. So it's clear from the features, we've only had a few chances to visit the seafloor at some of these seeps so far. And what we found there indicates that probably some of these seeps have been going well over 1,000 years, although we don't have any dates yet. But on the other hand, we know that small perturbations can cause episodic periods of methane emission. So it's probably a combination of timescales, some millennial thousands of years, some centuries, some decadal warming. And some actually we know that even within a season, the temperatures can change dramatically enough at the seafloor. We've seen this in the Arctic Ocean, that you could potentially destabilize gas hydrate over a large portion of the upper slope just by that temperature change within a few month period. So it's probably a combination.
Now, a few weeks ago, there was kind of a brouhaha on the web when a group announced, well, we're finding all of these sites where methane is bubbling up into the Arctic Ocean, thinking this might be because of climate change. This could be a really big problem. And one climate scientist responded on Twitter by saying, well, if this is true, and there was an if there, but if this is true, then, and to quote, we're effed. That response coming from a climate scientist clearly got a big response from the public. Is that the case? Is this a really dire thing that we're seeing happening to see these plumes of methane coming up from the seafloor where we didn't expect to see them before?
Well, the finding that you're discussing was coming out of a cruise on the Odin, the icebreaker from Sweden, a Sveris cruise. And most of the plumes that they were talking about were at a comparable depth to what we're discussing on the Atlantic margin. And the basic physics and chemistry show that methane emitted at those water depths, as long as it's not a catastrophic release, you're not failing an entire slope at once and releasing a huge amount of methane, that methane is not going to reach the atmosphere. It's primarily going to be consumed in the water column with the processes that Jeff discussed already.
And but as we were discussing at that point, that still means that it would get into the ocean and into the atmosphere as carbon dioxide.
Yes, right. That's true. But I think a lot of the discussion in the Arctic has sort of tended towards catastrophism. And so if that process is happening, as they say it is, it's important, certainly. But my guess is that when they go out and they do the methane measurements at the ocean interface, they're going to find that the methane is not crossing into the atmosphere.
Jeff Seawald, I'm curious, what was your reaction? You were kind of chuckling and nodding along as well. I mean, when you hear about these studies that we're seeing hundreds of sites where methane is bubbling out of the seafloor, does that to you sound dire, or does that sound like just par for the course?
I think we need to first fully understand what's happening to the methane in the water column. So before I start to panic, I want to know if it's actually reaching the atmosphere. And if methane does reach the atmosphere, the consequences are a lot more severe. So I think we need to first fully let the studies be finished and look at the full impact before we come to some conclusion on that issue. If it is reaching the atmosphere, then it's problematic. I think both Carolyn's and this Arctic study demonstrate is that our knowledge of methane leaving the seafloor is actually somewhat limited still. And there's a lot of work to be done to quantify the seeps and the amount of methane that's actually being released to the water column around the world.
And we actually did a calculation at the end of our paper and estimated that there are probably about, I mean, this is very rough, obviously, but there are probably about 9,000 undiscovered seeps if you take the density that we've got on our margin, on the Atlantic margin. And we thought our margin was cold, old, and boring. There was nothing really interesting happening.
And why would you think that?
Well, just because of its geologic setting. It's a place where most of the activity happened hundreds of millions of years ago. And it doesn't seem to be as dynamic, for example, as the California margin.
Not a lot of like undersea volcanoes, not a lot of earthquake. I mean, is that what we're talking about, earthquake and volcanic activity?
What we would call tectonic activity. And in the Gulf of Mexico, it seems to be a very dynamic environment, but that's primarily because of the nature of the geology. You have a big salt sheet under the northern Gulf of Mexico, and it's sort of heating up the sediments, and it's causing a lot of fluids and gas to flow often to the surface, to the seafloor. And we just don't have that on the U.S. East Coast. And so if we extrapolate, as I said, if we extrapolate the density that we found just back of the envelope to other similar margins, we would expect thousands of these seeps are out there now. And they're already part of the global methane budget to some extent, right? Because we know how much methane is in the atmosphere. And yet we have to find them first.
It seems surprising to me, given how much money and effort goes into finding fuel sources, that there could be thousands of natural gas seeps, not necessarily in the thousands of meters deep middle of the deep ocean, but closer to our shoreline here, that we haven't even discovered yet. Why don't we have a better handle on how many methane seeps there are? Is this a technological issue? Is this simply that we've never thought to look? What's the barrier?
Well, we were in a very rare situation in that we had a large regional data set that was collected in a very consistent way. And that's simply just not, if you think about how most scientists are funded, they go out, they have a 3-year study, they may go out on one cruise or two cruises. And even in a few week cruise, you can only get a small area mapped. So that was the huge advantage that we had here. I just want to back up a minute, though. I think most of these seeps are not areas that we would connect with energy necessarily. I know people often think that because they hear natural gas seeping out of the seafloor. But for example, on the U.S. East Coast right now, we have no reason to believe that these are an indicator of a deeper energy, a deeper natural gas deposit that could be tapped for potential energy. In other places, that situation could be different. In the Gulf of Mexico, sometimes these are indicators. But where we are on the East Coast, they're probably just leaking methane that's fairly shallowly produced.
Yeah, in order for there to be what you would call an economic deposit of natural gas, you need the correct geology to form reservoirs and traps so that the natural gas can actually accumulate in a form that we can actually produce and use for energy.
So there aren't large pools underneath the seafloor that are bubbling up. Is it actually Is this one of those examples of newly produced methane, or is it just that there's very small amounts gradually bubbling up?
A lot of it can be this so-called fossil methane. It can be older in the sense that it can be methane that was produced long ago that's been trapped in gas hydrates, for example. And gas hydrate sequesters methane. It traps it for a long period of time, but once it's destabilized, if it has a way out of the system, it could get out. It seeps.
So it is essentially a reservoir, just not a large enough one to be exploited.
Well,
it's a huge reservoir.
It's a large reservoir, but the technology currently doesn't exist to produce hydrates as a fuel resource.
Although Japan is pursuing this pretty ardently, there are certain kinds of hydrates that we talk about in our community that could eventually be useful for producing methane that could be used for energy resources. Also in permafrost environments, there are these types of hydrates. But the type that we're talking about, for example, in the Atlantic margin, these would generally be probably at lower concentration and in areas, and they wouldn't be exploitable, if you will. So.
Is there, I mean, you're talking about developing technologies. Several years ago, we didn't necessarily think that it was feasible to get natural gas out of shale, and now we have hydraulic fracturing, fracking, where, you know, there's a lot of attention being paid to that as a major source of domestically produced fuel. Is there the potential that we could do something like that on the seafloor? Could we do some sort of fracking and exploit this?
Well, we wouldn't do fracking. That's actually in our discussions of energy production from gas hydrates, it's something that's really never been discussed. Japan, of course, is aggressively pursuing production of methane from gas hydrate deposits because they primarily lack a domestic hydrocarbon resource. So the technology exists, and they're going to do what they need to do to get to that hydrocarbon resource, I think. And so it is feasible to do it now. What we are lacking in the research and development timeline right now is moving from the research where we do short-term production tests to show that we can get methane off the gas hydrates to the point that we can show that it's commercially viable. And that gap is large, and it's existed for about a decade. And it's likely that Japan and a few other countries that are pursuing this ardently will solve that problem.
Jeff Seewald, are there lessons that we can learn from the Gulf oil spill that might inform that type of technological development and pursuit? Is this something that we should be worried about as an environmental concern if we were to try to exploit some of these other gas hydrate reservoirs in the ocean?
Well, I think any time that you start pulling large resources off the seafloor, there are going to be environmental impacts. What those are, I think we probably do not fully understand the full implications at this point. Fundamentally, it's a very different type of accumulation of natural gas than the Deepwater Horizon. That was a conventional petroleum reservoir where you have a rock very deep in the subsurface that has large porosity, and natural gas and oil accumulate in the pore space of that rock. And we drill a hole into that reservoir and produce the oil. In a hydrate, it's more of a horizon at a certain depth in the seafloor, in the sediments, and you have to destabilize the hydrate or this ice-like structure to actually produce the methane from it. So there's significant, you would want to worry about what happens when you disturb the sediments. What is the near seafloor environmental impact of that?
That's Jeff Seewald of Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. Also with me, Carolyn Ruppel of the U.S. Geological Survey, and Sue Natale of the Woods Hole Research Center. We hope you'll join our conversation. Our phone number is 866-999-4626. You can email us at livinglabradio@capeandislands.org, or you can send Living Lab Radio a tweet or find us on Facebook. We'll talk more after a short break. Welcome back to Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. We're teasing apart some of the complexities of methane or natural gas this morning. With me is Sue Natale, an assistant scientist at Woods Hole Research Center, Jeff Seewald, senior scientist at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, and Carolyn Ruppel, head of the Gas Hydrates Program at the U.S. Geological Survey. Now, Sue Natale, one place where perhaps, and correct me if I'm wrong, we're seeing a more definite change in the amount of methane being released to the atmosphere is in the Arctic. We were talking about the seafloor and whether these are simply places that we haven't seen before or whether it's actually an impact of warming, but we are definitely seeing Arctic permafrost thawing. what kind of how widespread is that? How dramatic is that? And what kind of impacts are being seen in the Arctic as a result of the permafrost thawing?
So we are already seeing permafrost thaw. The projections for future thaw, there's still a lot of uncertainty surrounding them. But I think under our current emission scenario, we can expect to see about half of the surface permafrost, so the top 3 meters, will be thawed by the 21st century. We can reduce that. Even if we stopped emissions completely at this point, we would still continue to see permafrost thaw, but that 50% can be cut down to 10 or 20%. So there's very high certainty that permafrost is thawing, that permafrost will continue to thaw. There's lower certainty in how much of that permafrost, which contains a lot of organic carbon, once it's thawed, will be released to the atmosphere. The permafrost community has been working on this question and working on putting these permafrost carbon feedbacks to climate change, so emissions of carbon dioxide and methane, into global climate models. They currently are not in the latest IPCC report, so the IPCC climate models.
So when you say feedback...
So what I mean by feedback, scientists often use the term positive feedback when we're talking about the release of greenhouse gases to the atmosphere, say from biological sources. Those release of greenhouse gases will warm temperatures. This increasing temperatures will then thaw more permafrost. So we're meaning positive, not that it's good, but it's an amplification of climate warming. There's a lot of unknowns in terms of the processes because, you know, the Arctic is not a single place. It's a very heterogeneous system. And even most of the Arctic people have not studied. If you look at a map of, you know, with the points and where people have been in the Arctic, most of the people, at least in the U.S., go to Alaska. It's easiest to access. Most of the Arctic is in Siberia and in Russia, and we've only hit on a few points in these areas. So we haven't even been to most of the Arctic. I'd say 90% of the Arctic hasn't been visited by scientists. But given that and given all the unknowns, we do have some projections of how much permafrost is going to thaw and how much will be released by methane, as methane. Some estimates are about 3 to 4 petagrams of carbon will be released by 2100. To put that in perspective, that's about 10%. That's a cumulative amount by 2100. That's about 10% of our current total emissions on an annual basis, or 30%.
Should 10% be cause for alarm, or is that small enough to seem relatively minor?
Well, it's 30 to 50% of fossil fuel emissions, and that's only methane and not carbon dioxide. You know, is it cause for alarm? It's certainly cause for reducing fossil fuel emissions. It's certainly cause for putting these numbers in our accounting of how much fossil fuels are going into the atmosphere. If you don't count 10% here, 10% there, 10% there, you're all of a sudden adding yourself up to 30, 40%, 50%. And so those numbers are quite large. And that's by 2100. Once the permafrost starts to thaw, it's not going to freeze up again. It's going to continue. As I said, even if we stop all emissions, it's going to continue. That's 2100. We have even higher releases by, say, 2200, 2300. So those numbers are going to increase. I wouldn't call it – people sometimes refer to the carbon bomb as the permafrost.
Yeah, I've heard of the ticking time bomb of the Arctic.
It may not be in a sense of a bomb that's going to explode and, you know, all of it's going to come out at once, but there is going to be a slow release that I think the area for concern is that we can't stop it, right? It's like a tap that's going to continue running. We potentially can stop fossil fuel emissions, but this is one emission that we can't stop. So I think that's the cause for alarm.
Now, around the same time a few weeks ago that there were a lot of news stories about methane bubbling up from the seafloor in the Arctic, this new study finding methane seeps off the east coast of the United States, there was another story, and these all kind of got piled together and conflated, but there was another story that scientists had found from satellite images 3 huge craters in the Siberian permafrost that they don't think were there 2 years ago based on other satellite imagery. And you're saying we're not necessarily going to see this as a bomb, but I mean, one of the theories is that these craters were literally created by methane-fueled almost explosions in the ground. So where does our understanding of those craters stand at the moment, and how concerning are they?
Right. So I actually was in Siberia when that news story came out, and I was off the grid. So I just got back recently and have been catching up on it. And I think our understanding of that now is that that likely was caused by a buildup of methane. Not 100% certain. I think scientists are still trying to figure out what's causing these and going there to visit them. Methane concentrations at the bottom of this crater were quite high, about 10%, which is a lot higher than atmospheric. But again, I think the bigger cause for concern when we think about permafrost thawing is the permafrost, the carbon that's organic carbon right now. That pool of carbon is a lot larger than these methane hydrates in permafrost. But yes, this the latest understanding of this is that it likely was caused by methane and increasing temperatures either over the past few years or over a longer time period contributed to a buildup of pressure.
How surprising was it to you to see that and to see that that could happen? I mean, assuming that, that the methane theory is correct, is that anything that would ever have entered your mind as a possible effect of thawing permafrost?
Before it happened, no. I was my mind was focused on organic carbon that's, you know, going to be released by as methane by current microbes, not this buildup that's going to be sort of forming these craters. So I can't say I know how likely this is going to be and how common this will be. I'm not sure if anyone knows that. So I was surprised. And if it was caused by methane, I'll be surprised. But again, I'm not sure I don't think that's our biggest concern when we think about permafrost thaw and release of greenhouse gases as a result of permafrost thaw.
One of the interesting things about that particular area, as I'm sure you know, Yamal Peninsula, is that it is an area with a lot of shallow gas. It's shallow. It's not this microbial gas. It's a shallow thermogenic gas. So it's a huge gas production area. And so some of the figures that we've seen in our community, it wasn't gas hydrates related to this, obviously, it was too shallow, but there's a lot of gas, even at 60 meters in this area. And given the depth of that crater, it's very likely that you could have a buildup of methane. And if you have a sudden thaw, that you could easily produce something like that. And it was very interesting looking at the pictures. And most of us were working from pictures, obviously, that there seems to be some ejecta around this thing, which means that it wasn't just sort of a sudden drainage downward, which does happen.
It wasn't a sinkhole. It was actually an explosion.
Which happens in the Arctic sometimes.
Yeah, the original thought was that it was a collapsed Pingo, which is basically a big hill of
ice.
But
there was no hill before that either. So that was what was so interesting about it. All these, we call them morphologic, the shape of the Earth, all these geomorphologic features that would have had to be there first, like a thermokarst lake or an upraised area that we call a pingo, those did not exist prior to this thing forming. So it clearly seemed to be something new.
I'll add that on the seafloor, we actually see evidence for, I would call, catastrophic release of methane in the form of mud volcanoes, which they're not real mud volcanoes. They're actually, they look like a volcano, but it's actually mud that's ejected from the seafloor due to the buildup of gas and very high natural gas production rates. And those are quite common. You also see them on land, actually, in many areas.
Conversely, on the seafloor, you also see pockmarks, which are features that nowadays, so these are craters, essentially, usually filled in with sediment, and they're very common. There are 5,000 of them on the Atlantic margin, for example, and it's very similar areas to where we just mapped the seeps. But our work showed that none of these pockmarks are leaking methane now, and these pockmarks are common features of the seafloor, but we don't really know how they form. We just know that probably at some point in the past they leaked methane, but they're not nearly as deep as the feature the features that were found in the Yamal Peninsula in Siberia.
So coming from the oceanic perspective, when you saw the news about these craters, was your response, this is something completely new, or, oh yeah, that makes sense, we see that in the ocean all the time?
my response was that it was, you know, since I knew that it clearly wasn't a Pingo, and I knew that there wasn't a lake there that had drained suddenly ahead of time, and I knew there was shallow gas there, I figured it was some strange combination of gas exploding and a pockmark type feature. But as I said, it's way more profound than any pockmark we've ever seen in the ocean.
Did Jeff Seawell, did you find it surprising, concerning?
I was surprised, but when I thought about it a little bit, it seemed to make sense that something like this could happen. So, but it's the first I'd ever seen something like that happening.
I think there's a sense that there are a lot of unknowns about climate change, and because of that, it may not be as bad as some of the predictions. And then something like this comes along and highlights the fact that there are a lot of unknowns about climate change, and it could be a lot different and potentially worse than we're thinking. I mean, the idea that there are craters forming in Siberia potentially because of warming, and that idea had never entered anyone's mind, to me seems quite alarming that some of the unknowns could be that dramatic.
I agree. And I think, for me, I'm not doom and gloom, and we don't know what's going to happen, so it's going to be the worst, or we're effed. But I do think there's a lot that we don't know. And so when there's a lot that you don't know, it seems like you should, you know, prepare for that. And, you know, in terms of the Arctic and in terms of carbon and greenhouse gas releases from the Arctic, whether from these types of craters or whether from anaerobic decomposition and release of methane or aerobic decomposition release of carbon dioxide, we do want to start accounting for that. And so it's not something that you want to ignore. And there may be new sources that we already don't know about. So it is a cause for concern, but it's also something that we can take action on. And we can't take direct action to stop what's going on in the Arctic because we can't stop permafrost thaw. But we can reduce the potential for how much permafrost is going to thaw, and these other unknowns that we haven't been thinking about.
How, you know, you say prepare for this. Are the few residents of Siberia, of the Arctic, able in any way to prepare for permafrost thaw, really? I mean, for the ground that has always been solid to be turning muddy and potentially forming craters, is there any way to really prepare for that?
Well, I think it's something, I guess I shouldn't say prepare for, I think it's something the global community has to deal with, which is by reducing fossil fuel emissions. But I think that local communities, there is a lot of erosion, especially in coastal areas, and they're having to move whole communities, move houses. There are some engineering challenges that people can address by, you know, raising their houses up. I'm not an engineer, but there are ways to start considering it and dealing with it. But I do think it's something that the global community has to address.
And we're seeing in Alaska, the native communities are seeing a very large impact on their way of life. And that's everything from subsistence hunting to the undermining of the permafrost that is used to support their homes, the coastal erosion, to issues, for example, of cultural issues like burial grounds being eroded. So it's a profound issue, and in the United States we're facing it through intervention of the government mostly.
Jeff Seawald, we have just about a minute here, but I want to ask for kind of a final perspective, where, you know, there's some debate about how much of our attention in terms of reducing greenhouse gas emissions or our concern about climate change should be focused on methane. Should this be one of our top concerns, or should we be far more concerned about the more prevalent carbon dioxide and other issues?
Personally, I think there's so much we don't know about methane, and its potential impact is pretty significant. That as Sue was mentioning, it's very complex. The range of processes involved, from biological processes to geological processes to chemical processes, are all rather poorly constrained. And so, considering its potential, I think it does deserve significant attention and significant work in the future.
That's Jeff Seawald. He's a senior scientist in the Department of Marine Chemistry and Geochemistry at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. We also heard from Carolyn Ruppel, the head of the Gas Hydrates Program for the U.S. Geological Survey, and from Sue Natale, an assistant scientist at Woods Hole Research Center. Thank you to all of you for being here today, and thanks all for listening. This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone.
Living Lab on the Point is produced by Heather Goldstone, with assistance from Jenny Junker and Alicia Orsini. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Major support for Living Lab is provided by the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment. Additional support is provided by Lee McGraw through the Elizabeth B. McGraw Foundation. Living Lab is a production of WCAI, the local NPR station for the Cape, the Coast, and the Islands.